The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Let's start with an article from AARP, the magazine, under the heading of This is 70. Yikes, what is she wearing? My generation pioneered the miniskirt, but enough already. I'm noticing a lot of young women walking around New York somewhat naked. I tell myself not to judge the exposed midriffs and bellies, not to wonder, did she look in the mirror? I want to think instead, how great that she's body positive. You don't have to be a fashion analyst to see that what's fine for the gym is fine for the street. Tights and leggings bravely substitute for pants. Pants, slacks, trousers. My mother didn't own a single pair. This trend inspired me to Google Lycra. I learned that it can stretch to 8 times its normal size. One look around the supermarket tells me this is true. Recently, I couldn't help staring at a fellow passenger as we waited to board a flight. She was a tall, young, blonde woman, 25-ish, wearing a one-piece, full-length, leotard-like outfit. The work it would take to get it on and then get it off to use the bathroom. My high school, class of 68, mandated that girls wear skirts or dresses to the knees. Pants and jeans were banned. Even culottes were not allowed. Our gym uniforms were short versions of shirtwaist dresses in a heavy cotton. Prom gowns veered toward the preppy. My mother made mine, which was white pique, worn with long white gloves. Cleavage? No, not mine. Not anyone's. Later, as a pregnant boomer, I wore camouflaging maternity clothes. The dresses were cotton and flannel. Smocks were sweet rather than sassy, often ruffled, seemingly apologetic. Today's baby bumps are sheathed in tell-all lycra, proud belly button, protuberant beyond clingy to fused. I try to tell myself, good for her. It's a trophy. It's life. Quite literally. No apologies. I confess to watching Say Yes to the Dress, in which prospective brides try on wedding dresses. Really? This lazily transparent, plungy dress is the one that induces happy tears? Bride after bride said she wants to look her sexiest walking down the aisle. Maximum sexiness in wedding dresses? Since when? But then the judgmental me remembers how short I wore skirts and dresses in the late 60s and early 70s. I took up hems and rolled up the waistbands of my pleated skirts. I remember my mother asking forlornly, "Are you leaving the house like that?" I was. If my legs were chilled by Massachusetts winters, too bad. I didn't think I was being flirty. It was how my friends dressed. It was fashion. Good old fashion. Trying to ignore the outerwear that looks like underwear worn proudly on the sidewalks of New York, I tell myself, this too shall pass. And this was by Eleanor Lipman, 73, who's the author of 14 novels, most recently, Ms. Demeanor. Now, let's look at another article from AARP, the magazine. Big Money Woes? When to Call in the Pros. True Tales from the Financial Front Lines. How bad can your money problems get? We consulted professionals to find out and spill the beans on some of the most challenging situations they've encountered with their clients. Though we've changed the names and a few details to protect privacy, these stories highlight how even the most daunting money problems have solutions. Number 1. Selling a money pit. Elizabeth wanted to help selling her husband's house to contribute toward his care. George had moved to an assisted living facility about a year earlier. Elizabeth was living with her daughter, so George's empty house had fallen into disrepair. We listed the house, which had a mortgage balance of $190,000, for $325,000. But we soon learned that George had refinanced the house, adding $100,000 in debt. A buyer offered $330,000, but wanted nearly $10,000 in closing costs. The inspection revealed damage, prompting the buyer to ask for a $5,000 price cut. Then an $8,000 credit card debt popped up. Elizabeth would have had to pay $3,000 to close the sale. I started negotiating. First, the credit card debt came down. Then, the buyer lowered the repair cost to $2,500. I cut my commission by $1,500, and the buyer's agent reduced her fee by $500. Elizabeth walked away with only $800 or so, but she avoided more expenses or foreclosure. This was by Tabitha Richardson, real estate broker, Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Pro tip, when you sell a house, always be prepared for additional expense, from repairs to closing costs. But keep in mind that everything, absolutely everything, is negotiable. Now, number two, a $270,000 Social Security payment. Clara, 82, had never received a Social Security check despite contributing to the program since 1970. She had applied late, mistakenly believing that the monthly benefit based on her work record would continue to grow until she turned 72. It stops growing at 70. An even bigger problem was that when Clara, an immigrant, submitted her initial application to the Social Security Administration, SSA, she had lost the certificate of naturalization, proving she was a U.S. citizen. She requested a copy from the Federal Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency, USCIS, but the copy never arrived. 9 years later, in 2023, her daughter found her original certificate in a storage box. She and her mother hand-delivered it to her local SSA office. Yet Clara, 81 at the time, and facing financial difficulties, received no benefit. Her children then contacted my company. We identified a rule requiring the SSA to assist claimants in obtaining evidence of eligibility from other federal agencies. Clara had retained all the paperwork showing the SSA had never helped her with the unresponsive USCIS. So we drafted the necessary paperwork to compel the SSA to quickly address this issue. In March of this year, Clara recovered $270,325.60 and was approved for an ongoing monthly benefit of $3,336. This piece was by Matthew Allen, CEO of Social Security Advisors in New York City. And he has a pro tip. There are thousands of rules in the Social Security system. The average person doesn't know even three of them. And miscalculations and other errors on the part of the SSA are common. So document all of your interactions with the SSA. In tricky situations like this one, it may help to consult a professional. Now let's look at number three, the surprise $30 million. Jen and David, both in their 60s, lived in a $4 million house outside Philadelphia, drove luxury cars, and belonged to multiple country clubs. But David, a high-level executive, maintained a secret life with another woman. Once Jen discovered this, she wanted a divorce. The problem for Jen was that she had no knowledge of their investments, their net worth, or how much money David made. She had given up her job early in their marriage to care for their two children, now adults, and David had always kept her on an allowance. She had access to checking and savings accounts at their local bank, but that was it. So I assisted Jen in meeting with an attorney and initiating discovery, a formal legal process to investigate assets, debts, and other relevant information. We soon learned that David had purchased a house for his mistress. We also learned that he had substantial deferred compensation, money he was guaranteed to receive in the future, which Jen might be entitled to, but that wouldn't show up if you were just looking at the couple's current assets. The big shocker? The couple's net worth was about $30 million more than Jen had realized. Eventually, the court determined Jen was entitled to more than half of the couple's assets. David also agreed to maintain life insurance to cover alimony obligations. This was by Christine Palmer Hennigan, financial advisor and certified divorce financial analyst from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And the pro tip for this? Be prepared for the business side of divorce by getting a clear picture of your financial situation. Track your spending to document your standard of living. That's important in determining any future alimony payments. Build a balance sheet listing all of your properties, investments, and other assets and debts. Your insurance coverage and your tax return will help shed light on what you own. Continuing with this article, number 4, a skyrocketing insurance premium. Despite making no changes to their property and never filing a claim, Betty and Don, retirees in a $1.1 million house near Lake Tahoe, were dropped by their insurer. Under current California rules, the insurer could not properly underwrite and price the policy to cover the area's increased fire risk. I explained that to maintain similar coverage, they would have to replace their old $1,800 annual policy with two new ones. The first would cover everything but fire damage for $3,100 annually. For fire coverage, they would have to use California's FAIR plan, which stands for Fair Access to Insurance Requirements. More than 30 states offer last resort policies, providing basic coverage for properties exposed to high risks, typically from natural disasters. But the FAIR premium cost was still high, $6,800 for the couple's 2,000-square-foot home. To cut their premiums, we raised the deductible to $10,000 on the residential policy and to $15,000 on the FAIR policy. Next, we lowered the coverage of personal property on both policies from $700,000 to $150,000, removed coverage for an additional shed-like structure, and eliminated coverage for the cost of temporary housing if damage forced them from their home. That cut the total premium to about $6,000, down from nearly $10,000. It's still a lot more than what they were paying, and their coverage is lower, but they are protected. This was by Carl D. Sussman, insurance broker, Los Angeles. And a pro tip? Don't compare past insurance options with current ones. Today, you may need to either reduce your coverage or pay higher premiums. There are steps you can take, however, to reduce the likelihood of property loss, such as installing a non-combustible roof, covering the eaves to prevent embers from getting underneath, and clearing brush from around your house that may help lower your premium. Number 5, the caregiver and the credit cards. Christine, a busy executive working in New York City, hired us to investigate why her elderly mother, Agnes, was running out of funds every month. Agnes's expenses were minimal: utilities, groceries, medical bills, and could be covered with her monthly Social Security check. Christine owned the upstate New York home where Agnes lived and paid for Julie, Agnes's full-time caregiver. When we took over the account, we discovered that 7 checks had bounced in a 2-month period, including some to collection agencies. We also found that 8 credit card accounts had been opened relatively quickly with payment checks written to the card companies. Agnes, who had MS, could barely sign her name. Julie was filling out the checks. We alerted Christine, who obtained copies of the credit card applications, confirming Julie's involvement. At this point, the debt was close to $69,000. Christine consulted an attorney who said there was sufficient evidence to prosecute Julie. But Agnes, who loved Julie, refused to pursue legal action and wanted to keep her on. Christine's brother eventually took over daily money management, and Julie was required to provide receipts for all expenses. This was from Keely Kriske, daily money manager with Financial Sense, Darien, Connecticut. And the pro tip? Place a freeze on your loved one's accounts with the 3 main credit bureaus so no one can open a new credit line in their name. Also, set up online access to their financial accounts so you can monitor activity and request fraud alerts. We have 2 more, so let's keep going. A mother's big small business debt. This is number 6. Nancy, a retiree who had owned a small business for most of her career, passed it down to her daughter, Amy. A year later, Nancy started getting calls from the issuer of the company's credit card, which still had her Social Security number on the account. It turned out that the balance on the card, which had been 0 when Nancy retired, now amounted to $50,000, and the business was on the brink of collapse. Although Nancy had saved for retirement, she couldn't afford to pay off the debt. Since her account had fallen delinquent and her credit rating had plunged, she couldn't get a bank loan or transfer the balance to another card. But as a nonprofit credit counseling agency, we were able to negotiate with her creditor to lower the interest rate on the debt to under 2%, cutting her payments from $1,400 a month to $700 a month. We also advised Nancy to return to work part-time, which she did. Today, she is doing well. And this was by Laura Sicarelli, credit counselor, American Financial Solutions, Bremerton, Washington. And the pro tip? Communicate with family members or anyone who has the ability to affect your credit rating. If you encounter financial problems, seek help to negotiate better terms. And finally, weighing the cost of college. One family approached us in the fall of their daughter Sarah's senior year of high school. They had no college savings, and the parents weren't willing to take out loans. Sarah had a list of 10 schools she was interested in. Her top choice was Boston University, which cost more than $85,000 a year. But based on her parents' income and assets, she wouldn't qualify for need-based aid. If she chose Boston University, with a 4-year cost of roughly $350,000, she would need to fund it herself through loans. Choosing a college can get very emotional, and sometimes the emotion prevents people from thinking through the long-term financial implications of the decision. So, we went through the numbers to let the consequences sink in. For every $10,000 Sarah borrowed, she would expect a $100 monthly payment. With loans potentially exceeding $300,000, this could mean a monthly payment of at least $3,000. Meanwhile, an average starting salary is about $5,000 a month. You hate to see a 17-year-old who has barely gotten a driver's license make a decision to start life with that much debt. We showed Sarah how other schools on her list were more affordable. We wanted to prepare her for financial success beyond graduation. Ultimately, she chose an in-state school with an annual cost of around $35,000. And this was by Andrew Holmes, financial planner specializing in college funding, Newton, Massachusetts. And the pro tip? Begin the college selection process early and focus on schools that offer generous need-based or merit-based financial aid, depending on your circumstances. Prestigious selective schools may be enticing, but you can receive an excellent undergraduate education at a school that aligns with your financial requirements. Now, for the rest of our time, we're going to look at an article from AARP, the magazine, again. SNL hits the big 5-0, a very subjective celebration of Saturday Night Live, America's longest-running comedy show. This is by Joel Stein. Lorne Michaels knows your favorite seasons of Saturday Night Live. They were the ones that aired when you were in high school, right before you got a driver's license, when you were stuck at home with no money. Staying up until 1 a.m. was exciting. Seeing adults saying things no one is supposed to say, it blew your mind. Then you graduated, and the SNL cast members did too. And the new ones somehow weren't quite as funny. This is why it's a rite of passage to quote SNL catchphrases to high school friends. They become a generational secret handshake, each demo laughing at its own nonsensical cheeseburger, cheeseburger, Pepsi, Pepsi, making copies, or more cowbell. Michaels, 79, created the show in 3 weeks in 1975 when it first aired, though SNL's 50th season starts this fall, when Johnny Carson pulled weekend repeats of The Tonight Show so he could use them during the week to take days off. Since then, other than the 5 seasons Michael left the show, 1980 to 85, he's been in charge every week, leaving a bigger mark on American comedy than anyone since Mark Twain. SNL has not only won more Emmys, 98, than any other show, it has also spun off 12 movies, 3 late-night TV hosts, Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, and Conan O'Brien, and many movie stars. Michaels has vowed to stay at SNL until the 50th anniversary, but he has talked about having his protege, former head writer Tina Fey, take over when he leaves. It's hard to imagine the show without him, but it's harder to imagine American culture without the show. To celebrate SNL's big 5-0 season, we've picked some of its best moments and characters. Feel free to tell us how wrong we were at facebook.com/AARP. And don't forget to score your quiz for your SNL IQ. Let's start with unforgettable skits and characters. We all have favorites. Here are 5 of ours. Blues Brothers, 1978 to 82, before John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd sang on SNL, their sole review opened shows for Steve Martin. Their first album, Briefcase Full of Blues, was number 1 on the Billboard chart and went double platinum. Ed Grimley, 1984 to 96. Martin Short's surreal creation with his hiked pants, enormous cowlick, inability to play the triangle, and love of Wheel of Fortune was a human cartoon. He was completely mental, we must say. Church Lady, 1986 to 2016. As the finger-wagging, judgy host of a Christian talk show, Dana Carvey displayed moral superiority by literally doing a superiority dance strut. Often she asked, could it be Satan? It really was special. Wayne's World, 1989 to 2015. The Illinois high school buddies with a public access show partied on in 2 movies, the first of which made the most money of the 12 films based on SNL sketches. Yes, including the Blues Brothers. Swing indeed. What's Up With That? 2009 to 19. Kenan Thompson is brilliant as a singing talk show host who cuts off his guests with sing-song questions as dancers, most unforgettably the track-suited Jason Sudeikis, and performers pour onto the stage. Honorable mention, Matt Foley, motivational speaker, Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy Dunies McGrober. Now, SNL by the numbers. Who topped the Saturday Night Live casting charts? Most years as a cast member, Kenan Thompson, 21, Daryl Hammond, 14, Seth Meyers, 13. Most times hosting, Alec Baldwin, 17, Steve Martin, 16, John Goodman, 13. Youngest when debuted as a cast member, Anthony Michael Hall, 17, Eddie Murphy, 19, Robert Downey Jr., 20. Now we have memorable musical performances. Neil Young, 1989. Young and a tight three-piece band roared their way through Rockin' in the Free World, a song about the environment, President George H.W. Bush, poverty, and the nation's nature of freedom in North America. No stunts, no gimmicks, just raw power. Taylor Swift, 2021. In 2009, Swift hosted for the first time. Then in 2021, SNL broke with its usual format so Swift could play a 10-minute version of All Too Well about a painful breakup. The Replacements, 1986. On their only SNL appearance, guitarist Bob Stinson wore a unitard. Singer Paul Westerberg dropped an F-bomb, and for two sloppy, magnificent songs, they carried the torch for reckless carousing. Elvis Costello and the Attractions, 1977. 4 bars into Less Than Zero, which he was expected to play, Costello shouted, "Stop!" and burst into the scathing "Radio, Radio," then sped through the song as if trying to finish before the police came. Costello was banned from SNL, but returned in 1989. The Funky 4 Plus 1, 1981. When Debbie Harry of Blondie hosted SNL, she requested the rappers Funky 4 Plus 1 as her musical guest. The Bronx Crew played their joyous single, That's the Joint, exposing the audience to hip-hop. An honorable mention for this category, David Bowie, 1979, B-52's, 1980, Prince, 1981, O'Connor, 1992, and Kendrick Lamar, 2014. Well, folks, we have reached the end of our time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.